Hello and welcome everyone to the Ecom Sales Tax Podcast, a multi-state tax solutions production. In this podcast, our goal is to help e-commerce sellers and their advisors keep up with the constantly changing world of sales tax. And boy, is it ever changing. So let's get started. I'm your host, Andy Johnson, and I've got with me my co-host, Dan Peisner. Dan is one of the country's foremost authorities in the world of e-commerce. And in fact, my assistant author of the AICPA course on multi-state income tax. So Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Andy. Happy to be here.
All right. So we have some really exciting news to talk about today that will be of interest to all e-commerce sellers, pretty much to the extent that e-commerce sellers are interested in sales tax, of course. But it's particularly interesting to those of us, Dan, who live and breathe sales tax. And I'm talking about the oral arguments yesterday in the Wayfair case at the U.S. Supreme Court. You and I have talked a lot about that, and I know that you have been reading over the transcripts and have a lot of comments to say. So I'd like to start, Dan, if I could. I'm going to share my screen. I'm going to share this article that I just read today, as a matter of fact, on LinkedIn, and it's from James Sutton, and or maybe I saw a link to it, I think. It's a National Review article, and it's a state's angle for more sales tax. And so that's really what's happening with Wayfair, is states are looking for more revenue. And you can't blame them, I guess, because that's what they think is the most important thing, right? Will states ever say, Dan, that they have enough revenue?
Never, never. More is always better for the states.
Right, man, because even if you're collecting more than you spend, then you put that away in the quote-unquote rainy day fund. So now the states have embarked on their Kill Quill campaign. So, Dan, give us just the briefest update, or not update, but review of what Quill was and why would states want to overturn it?
Certainly, Andy. Quill was a U.S. Supreme Court case that was decided back in 1992. And what it was is back in the day, you had your mail order catalog. If you wanted to order bulk office supplies and you didn't want to have to go down to your local Office Depot or Office Max, you'd break out the old Quill catalog, or so I'm told. And you would order, put in your supply order, and the goods would be delivered by common carrier. And the state of North Dakota decided at the time that Quill needed to be collecting sales tax on all the sales of supplies into North Dakota, and they filed suit within their went through the whole process that the states go through. They issued a notice. Suit was filed, and it went all the way up to the North Dakota Supreme Court. Which, surprise,
that
surprise,
was back in 1992. Dan, how old were you in 1992?
Oh boy, I was. Don't make me do the math on that one, Andy. I was in grade
school. You were four, I think. No. You were
nine.
Six.
Oh, sorry, yeah, six.
Yeah. So I remember when you were just a little boy, because 1992 is when your dad and I started the firm. And who would have thought that Quill would be such an important case? So it goes to the Supreme Court. So sorry, I interrupted you. The Supreme Court said what?
Supreme Court took a look at it, and they said they looked at a prior case, National Bellis Hess, and they said they looked at part of it and said, you know, maybe this is a little bit easier than we thought. But the core of it, the idea of a dormant commerce clause that you had to have more than the slightest physical presence within the state, they took a look at that, and they said this is good. That based on the cost of compliance, the difficulties in complying with the sales and use tax laws, that you have to have more than the slightest physical presence. They declined to fully overturn Bellis Hess, and they found that they reversed the North Dakota decision. And what was one of the things that was important is the state had asserted that there were a whole 5 floppy disks that Quill had within the state. And North Dakota was trying to say, look at this, physical presence, 5 disks, you own it. And the Supreme Court said that that's not enough. So they declined.
But at least the Supreme Court said that at least for sales tax, before a state can force you to collect their sales tax, you have to have at least some physical presence, more than a slight physical presence. And 5 software diskettes was not enough. So that was a big strike against the states trying to make remote sellers collect sales tax. Obviously, it's before the days of e-commerce, the way it is today, of course. So they couldn't have anticipated how much commerce would be done over the internet back then. But that at least protected remote sellers from over-aggressive states, at least for a while. Now things have changed and changed and evolved. States keep winning little marginal victories. And at this point, states are very aggressive when asserting nexus. And then we come to a decision, the DMA case, the Broll decision, right, where the Supreme Court, in a kind of a parenthetical comment by Justice Kennedy, he said, you know, I think Quill was a bad decision. If a state were to pass a law and someone sued them and brought it, we would probably take that case and try to overturn Quill. And so that was just a few years ago. And so that's what South Dakota did. So Quill was North Dakota. And then South Dakota passed a law making it that it doesn't matter if you have any physical presence. If you just have 200 transactions in our state, you have to collect sales tax in our state. And they got sued by Wayfair. And now it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's the case we're talking about, right, Dan?
This Wayfair. Exactly.
So that's just a brief overview. Most of you would have known all of that, but I just want to give a little bit of background. I just sprang that on Dan because we hadn't talked about giving a overview of Quill, but Dan, way to go. You nailed it. So let me go back to sharing this article because there's been, I don't remember, Dan, do you know how many states filed briefs in favor of overturning Quill?
Oh, it was... It had to be 35, 40 states. I don't remember the exact number.
I saw like the number like 42 somewhere in there. So it's no surprise, is it, that the states would want to overturn Quill, right?
Yeah, I think the only states that don't want to overturn Quill is states that don't have a sales tax because they don't want their own businesses to have to file and report sales tax.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So, you know, there was a lot of prognostication about, obviously, Quill is going to be overturned. That was probably, if you polled every observer, what would you say, Dan? 75% of people knowledgeable on this topic would say it's probably going to be overturned?
It depends on when you polled them. The poll that was going around back when this was up for cert amongst the practitioners I talked to, even the number 2 guy in the Alabama Department of Revenue did not think that they were going to grant cert on it. And once they granted cert, it kind of did seem like it was flipped. And a lot of the practitioners thought, well, if they're going to look at it, if Kennedy put that out there, then they're going to overturn it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't think they would take the case in the first place. As you know, Dan, you and I talked about this a lot, but they did. And then once they took it, I don't know. I don't want to predict these things. I don't think that they should overturn Quill. And that's why I wanted to share what James Sutton wrote. This is sort of a summary of a brief that he filed with the Supreme Court, and just points out a few of his bullet points. So he says that overturning Quill would mean that all businesses have to know all the constantly changing sales tax rules and court cases in all these states that have sales tax, 45 states, and over 10,000 sales tax jurisdictions. So I think that's probably a little bit of, you know, that may be overstating it just a little bit, Dan, but that's basically what Quill, overturning Quill would mean. You'd have to have a lot more knowledge about sales tax than you did before.
Exactly right. Is the way you would, depending on how it's decided, you would have to know, you would have to be in compliance with any number of states. And as soon as you start selling into that state, you are deemed automatically to know the exact taxability, every law, every regulation, every court case that applies to it. They always say that ignorance is no excuse for the law, and right there, that consistently with the states, that has been practiced and breached.
So sometimes people will say, oh, that's just a bunch of hyperbole because states aren't going to be that aggressive. But even Marty Jackley, who was the South Dakota Attorney General, and Malcolm Stewart, who was the Deputy Solicitor General, or is, arguing on behalf of overturning Quill, as I read the transcripts, both admitted that if Quill were overturned, if they binarily said Quill is no longer valid, then we would fall basically to complete auto transit, and that even one sale in a state would create nexus. So I think what James is saying is, hey, all of a sudden, all these businesses would have to be versant in all these state tax laws. So I thought that was interesting. Now, you might say, listen, how complicated can it be? Because you just have to collect the tax. What's the problem? Well, because the way sales tax works is you're supposed to, if you have nexus, then you're supposed to collect tax on every transaction. And if you don't, then you become liable. So it's supposed to fall on the purchaser. But if you don't collect it from some mistake or some missing documentation, then you become liable for the tax that you didn't collect from your customers. Maybe there's, you know, the case of Illinois, I think, that had conflicting information about taxability of shipping. And you just decide, hey, based on this guidance from Illinois Department of Revenue, I'm not collecting tax on shipping. And then later come to find out, no, the right hand said, no, shipping is taxable. Well, then you've lost your chance, and then you get audited and you should have collected tax and you didn't. So it becomes your liability. Any comment you'd like to make on that bullet point, Dan?
It's interesting that you mentioned Illinois and shipping, because there's another trap for the unwary there. And that's if you, Illinois is one of a couple of states that's active in this. If you undercollect the tax, you have, in often cases, you have to worry about the state coming after you. If you collect tax where you're not supposed to, you have to worry about the plaintiff's bar coming after you for civil suits under a quitam or a class action case, depending on whether you've under or over collected. So you've got to not just collect the tax, but you've got to get, in a couple of these states, you've got to do it just right. And if there's a gray area, it may not be the Department of Revenue you're sorting it out with.
Exactly. So what James is pointing out, that even small businesses now would have all of, you know, it's one thing if you're a big business and you have the resources to deal with these things, but now small businesses would just get stuck. Next bullet point. Businesses would be subject to expensive multi-year sales tax audits, on average 8 audits per year. And the average sales tax assessment for even a medium business under audit is over $100,000. So Dan, you pointed this out to me when you read his brief, that this point he's making here, he cited Pisner-Johnson on that. And it comes from a report that we did with Avalara last year, where they had some data in their collections of how much audits cost. And certainly, I think this number is accurate for audits that we get involved in, right? And you could say, well, we only get involved in audits that are particularly painful. So whether or not 100,000 is the actual average, who can calculate that? But it's not ridiculous, because he says for even a medium-sized business, it might not be the average size audit for a very small business. But even for a very small business, Dan, you and I have worked on some audits for over 100,000. And if you have to deal with an audit in some foreign state where you really have no recourse, you can't throw yourself on the mercy of your legislator, nothing. You really have no shot at getting that thing reduced.
And I think that 100,000 also misses an important point. And that's, as you and I both know, with these audits, not only is there a cost in dollars, but in time, just in responding to the auditor, document requests, trying to figure out, look at the tax law that you may or may not have known about, try to educate the auditor on your business, because oftentimes they're not an expert. And it's even for a smaller dollar audit, or even if there's no tax due, getting to that point can be very painful.
Yeah. Matter of fact, in the report that he cited that we did, that's what we were calculating in that number, that combined actual assessment, professional fees, time spent by the company is over $100,000 in costs. And I think that that's pretty accurate.
I would agree.
Another thing I wanted to point out is that since sales tax is considered a trust fund, sort of like payroll tax, compared to income tax, this means that a business and the owners are subject to harsh civil and criminal penalties that can't be extinguished by bankruptcy. And he makes this point in Florida, and there's other states, but Florida seems to be one of the most draconian on criminal penalties. It says in Florida, a person's failure to remit just $301 of tax they collected subjects that person to a felony charge and potentially 5 years in prison and 30 years if it's over 100. Now, that is really, really rough. And James, I know from talking to him, has lots of examples of Florida business owners being subject to very, very harsh penalties. So Quill gets overturned. The state of Florida says one sale gives you nexus, and you didn't know it, and you didn't collect you just didn't realize what you were selling wasn't taxable, and you're collecting tax on it, or whatever. You're just not remitting, say, $301 in tax. You could have a felony on your hands. So also, sales tax liabilities can't be extinguished in bankruptcy, nor are they you protected if you're an officer or an owner in a company by the corporate bail, because most states, as he said, have the ability to pierce it, the corporate bail, to impose penalties directly on the owners, even if it wasn't their primary responsibility. He says fining them up to 200% of the tax owed. So, we talk about those types of things all the time in terms of, just making sure you're compliant. But if Quill is overturned, the bar for registration requirements for Nexus would be so low, you'd automatically be subject to so many potential penalties. And Dan, that's some of what came out in these oral arguments almost right off the bat. And I want to just mention a few, Dan, and I know you've got some points that you'd like to make, but just some of the things that I thought were interesting and I'd like to get your take on it, Dan, is I liked what, first of all, my general comments about this, the oral arguments, is that I was pleasantly surprised that the Supreme Court justices seemed to know what they were talking about. I've done many administrative hearings, and it almost seems like sometimes the administrative law judge, who's supposed to be an expert in state taxes, doesn't even seem to know what's going on. And yet, when I read these oral arguments and the questions by the justices, I was pretty impressed. And it seemed like they had read the briefs. How about you, Dan?
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, they were knowledgeable. They had numbers. They were bringing up the very arguments from the briefs and even from the, I think there had to be over 30 amicus briefs filed by different parties, and I think they read a lot of them. I don't know if they read every one of them, but they were definitely, they knew their stuff.
I'm pretty sure they read the one by James Sutton, because it seemed like they were citing some of his numbers. And some of his big points were about the cost to small business, and that seemed to be a theme for many of the justices. How much it's going to cost to get your system set up, how much it's going to cost to defend yourself. So I think just in reading the oral arguments that they must have given some weight to what he said. So I thought that Mr. Stewart, okay, so Malcolm Stewart is the deputy solicitor general. Okay, so he's the lawyer for the United States government. And he got in on this because he filed a brief favoring petitioner South Dakota. And matter of fact, got 10 out of the 30 minutes allocated to Marty Jackley, right? To give his argument. And so I thought to myself, man, he didn't do South Dakota any favor, because for one thing, he agreed, as I mentioned a moment ago, that there would be no constitutional minimum number of orders that would subject a company to Nexus if Quill is overturned. So for even those justices, say like Kennedy and Ginsburg, right, which seemed to me like they just wanted to overturn Quill, barring anything. You would think that this would have to give even them pause, that what they would get by overturning Quill is states pursuing somebody just because they made one sale in their state. What do you think, Dan?
I think you're right. The solicitor general deputy solicitor general was his argument seemed largely to be based on a just pure law, pure he even, I believe at one point he mentioned the fact that making one sale into a state would cause them to be at a loss for due to the compliance of sales tax and the complexities is not a constitutional deficiency. His position seemed largely, let's throw out all the emotional arguments. Let's throw out all of the hardships that the other justices are looking at. And let's just look at this on a pure constitutional law basis.
So I thought a very interesting exchange. I would have loved to be there to watch it. Ginsburg was saying that, you know, obviously she wants to overturn it. And so one of the big fears is that states would go back retroactively. And so one reply to that was, well, no, states aren't thinking about going retroactively. I think it might have been Breyer who said, hey, you know, we have no guarantee that states won't try to get every possible dollar, you know. But anyway, so Justice Ginsburg throws out, hey, Mr. Stewart, what if our ruling, we said it should be only applied prospectively? And wouldn't that do away with the whole idea of with that big fear that states would go back retroactively. And when I hear stuff like this, it just makes me cringe a little bit, because Justice Ginsburg is putting herself in the shoes of a legislator. And so I thought that Mr. Stewart's answer was perfect from my own personal viewpoint. But I thought it was very damaging to South Dakota's case, because he said, I think the court has eschewed prospective announcement of constitutional rules, because the court's role is to interpret the Constitution, not to amend it. If the court says in June of this year, which is when this ruling is supposed to be issued, that the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is what you were talking about, Dan, a few minutes ago, means X, it can't say that up until now, the Dormant Commerce Clause meant something else, when now it means something else again, right? So in other words, your job, Justice Ginsburg, is not to amend the Constitution and say, from now on, the Constitution, as far as the Dormant Commerce Clause, means this. It did mean that before, but it means this from now on. He says, in that sense, prospective decision-making is inconsistent with the judicial role. And I thought, a couple of things. One, obviously, I agree with, you know, judicial restraint as a principle. But I thought also in reading that, you know, under that kind of pressure on the fly to make that cogent reply and, you know, something that could be quoted without changing it was pretty impressive.
I agree. I mean, if nothing else, the Deputy Solicitor General is very, he strikes me as a very staunchly legal scholar, and he kept it very much in what does the law say. And while I'm not an attorney, nor do I play one on podcasts, the Supreme Court is whenever they make a judgment, they're not just writing their opinion on something and how they feel. They very much have to look at it in the context of how is this going to affect future decisions, not only in sales tax, but in everything else. And, I believe there was even some argument in, by Mr. Isaacson about the fact that there would be a retroactivity issue, that the court really couldn't just do it prospectively based on how they've ruled in the past. And that was a huge sticking point that he brought up, is that there's really no guarantee. One of the quotes that struck me most actually came from Justice Alito, and he said South Dakota law is obviously a test case, and he said you know, it was devised to present the most reasonable incarnation of the scheme, but do you have any doubt that the states who are tottering on the edge of insolvency and municipalities which may be even in worse position have a strong incentive to grab everything they possibly can?
Right. It was Alito that said that. Yeah. I mean, I thought that was a very damaging comment too.
Yeah.
Did you think that there was anything really great on the side of South Dakota? I mean, I know we have some justices that seem bent on overturning Quill, but was there any real big score made by South Dakota that you could detect?
I think the only thing they had going for them is the argument that if you don't give us this, something worse is waiting in the wings in the form of the notice and reporting schemes. That was brought up, and I was actually kind of surprised that Isaacson, the attorney for Wayfair, actually said it might have been Roberts put it to him point blank, which do you think is worse, the notice and reporting or compliance? And he said notice and reporting was easier, which yeah. for a big sophisticated company like Wayfair, that's got a lot of programmers on staff and can crank out these notices and reporting and really tune that, that might be true. But for a lot of these smaller taxpayers that we've been talking about, the kinds that don't have a miles deep IT department and programmers on staff in three countries, I don't think it is going to be that easy to comply. Notice and reporting is certainly not a panacea. It's something we've been advising our clients about. Some states have some real traps in it. And it's really the only viable option for a lot of them is to get registered and go down that road, audits and all.
Right. I thought, Dan, that it was very interesting that there were several mentions of the Colorado situation, the notice and reporting. And we have other podcasts that talk all about that situation in Rhode Island, Colorado. So if you need to know more about notice and reporting, check those out. But Dan, every time they mention notice and reporting, I especially noticed that they never say anything bad about it. Like, if you think Quill is bad, or if you think overturning Quill is bad, you know, notice and reporting is way worse. You know, they seem to all know about notice and reporting, for one. That was interesting. And they didn't seem to think it was anything wrong with it. They kind of said, you know, notice and reporting might be the thing that forces Congress and states to come to some compromise. But if we overturn Quill, states have no reason to compromise. There's no reason for them to push Congress to pass some comprehensive reform because states have everything they want. They have Nexus after one sale and in notice and reporting, they have all the tools. So why would states want to press Congress for any compromise?
I don't think they would. And unless you have some, the big sellers for some reason decided that they did want that compromise, or a particularly strong lobbying group decided that they wanted some kind of a compromise. And even then, the big groups have been at this for years, and the closest they got was the Marketplace Fairness Act, which made it through one part of Congress. It got through the Senate one year and the
2013,
House.
2013, Dan. I was just looking that up. And that was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and the House didn't want to touch it. And oddly enough, I believe that did come up in the argument yesterday. The reason that Congress hasn't wanted to touch it is because it's largely seen by a lot of constituents as a tax increase.
Right.
It's dead on arrival in the House as of right now, and they were kind of pushing notice and reporting as this thing that would make it the lesser of two evils.
So, well, notice and reporting to the extent, so let's say that Quill isn't overturned. Notice and reporting will become the thing. You know, all these justices seem to endorse it. So this is something that I talked about last year, that I thought that notice and reporting was going to be the new thing. Now I feel more strongly than ever that states, regardless of what happens with Quill, are just going to pass notice and reporting statutes that will just force everyone to register. Because here you have all the Supremes are saying it sounds good to them. And then eventually when that is so onerous, then enough businesses will clamor to Congress and maybe there will be some solution. I want to share something else, Dan, and if you have other notes you want to share. I have this comment by Justice Elena Kagan that I thought was really interesting, because if you read the Everything Store, I think it's the unauthorized biography of Amazon, but very interesting. And it quoted, I think Bezos is saying that moving to Washington was very important because there's no income tax. Plus, using this mail order model allowed them not to charge sales tax. That was critical to their success, right? Initially, for any internet retailer, not having to charge sales tax gave them a way probably to at least offset the shipping cost. And so it put them more on equal footing with Main Street retailers. Now I think I read a study that 80% of people don't care about the sales tax when they buy something. And Amazon collects tax in every state that has a sales tax on their own sales. But now it's Amazon, ironically, that is advocating to overturn Quill, right? And so Justice Kagan says this. She says, now there's something a little bit ironic in saying that the problem with Quill is that it benefited all these companies, meaning she cited specifically Amazon, eBay, and Etsy. I'm not sure how much it's benefited eBay, because eBay is not like Amazon, really. They don't take ownership of goods. But anyway, so there's something a little bit ironic in saying that the problem with Quill is that it benefited Amazon, say. So now we're going to overturn Quill so that we can benefit the exact same companies. And I thought that that's interesting, because now it's Amazon, who already collects sales tax in all these states. They win big if Quill is overturned. They, among others, win big if Quill is overturned, because it presents this huge barrier to entry to any independent seller, and basically drives them into the arms of Amazon to sell their goods through Amazon's marketplace. So Amazon can earn a commission on the sale of goods, and Amazon earns, I think it's 2.9% on every tax dollar that they collect in your behalf as well. So Amazon wins all the way around. I love Amazon, by the way. But I thought that comment by Justice Kagan was really very insightful. It shows that she's really thought through this, because most people would not have arrived at that conclusion, which I think is absolutely correct.
I fully agree. And to your point about driving people towards Amazon, we've been talking about how difficult it is to comply with this, with the tax collection and reporting responsibilities. The other thing that the states are doing to try to pick up the slack, so to speak, without having to go to having to get Quill overturned, is that they've been working on passing laws to make Amazon actually have to collect and report that tax on behalf of all their third party sellers. Washington was kind of the first one to do it, and Amazon didn't fight them. And now Pennsylvania has done it, and as of April 1st, Pennsylvania's collecting all that tax on their behalf. So now, if the states all follow that trajectory, Amazon is going to be in the position of saying, tax is hard, sell through us and we'll take care of it for you. Not just the charging of it, but also the remittance of it and the reporting of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so big day, Dan, because the last time that a sales tax case was heard in oral arguments at the Supreme Court level was when you were 6 years old. And when I was barely aware of Supreme Court issues with sales tax. So obviously it goes without saying, but I'll say it, that this doesn't happen every day. And I've enjoyed talking it over. Any other comments you'd like to make about that, the oral arguments?
I think the only other comment is, based on my reading of it, I think I was trying to, like everybody else, I was trying to figure out which way the justices were leaning. And full disclosure, even the experts get this wrong. Justices oftentimes they'll play devil's advocate, and they'll pick at the weaknesses of any side. But based on what I heard, just my amateur opinion, it sounds like Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Gorsuch are for overturning. Clarence Thomas was characteristically silent, but in past writings, he's kind of been seen as being in the overturn camp as well, so most people have him down. I thought that Sotomayor and Kagan were pretty strongly for sustaining Quill and letting it stay. Roberts is leaning that way. However, he was not so much because of the small business and the interruption and the hardship, but he actually made the point that with tax collection increasing and with all the big collectors all collecting tax and all these other changes we've talked about, he thinks that the problem has kind of peaked and that the collection gap is going to be getting smaller even as e-commerce rises, because so many people are collecting. And as you said, consumers are less are less adverse to paying that sales tax. And so I think I put Roberts in the sustain. And honestly, I wasn't quite sure where Breyer and Alito are going to come out. They attacked both sides. They seem to kind of be maybe waffling a little bit as I read it, and that they maybe had an opinion, but they still had concerns. So it's anybody's game. I haven't seen anybody that really thinks that we've got a 5-4 decided already.
Right. Yeah. And maybe some of them have not decided truly. So it'll be very interesting to watch. I will not make a prediction, but I think that it's not nearly the slam dunk that I thought. I read most experts to seem to be lining up, that most experts were saying after it was accepted for cert, that most experts were saying, yeah, Quill is going to be dead no matter what. I think one thing we can say with certainty is no matter what happens with Quill, things will get more complicated for sellers, not less. Because I agree, I think, with maybe it was Kagan who said this, that basically the decision is binary. You know, you're faced with this court case, and you have to rule on the facts of the case. So you can either say Quill should be overturned or not. There's probably plenty of nuances that you could throw in there. But you can't give a bunch of examples. I don't think you can say this should only be applied prospectively. I don't see how the Supreme Court could say that. So it will never be as clear cut as if Congress passed some laws with regulations and examples and took in the input from all sides, and then made something that was a reasonable compromise, because it does seem like there's got to be some reasonable compromise. And right now, there's just an disproportionate burden on remote sellers, even remote sellers who do operate a brick and mortar store in their home state, but they want to sell over the internet, which I think I saw a figure in those oral arguments that it's like 80% of small, you know, brick and mortar stores have their own website, and it's expected to be 90% in the next some number of years. So I know that the states tend to want to pit remote sellers as the villains versus Main Street companies as the good guys. But whatever they twisted ruling that the Supreme Court comes out with here, assuming they come out with a twisted ruling, will affect both Main Street sellers and remote sellers. So it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. So Dan, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your expert insight and knowledge. And for those of you who have questions, those of you who are members of the Inner Circle, by the way, stay with us, because we'll be answering your specific questions. This podcast is now over, Dan. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Andy.